From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a 35-year-old man named Archie Jabadi walked up the narrow stairwell and stopped at the second floor landing of his apartment building. He has lived there for some time, but he is not just a tenant. He's also the landlord. Last February, Archie won an eviction case against one of his tenants for failure to pay rent. As the Washington Post reported, it was the end of a saga that included claims of drug use, noise complaints in the middle of the night, and many other frustrations raised by neighbors. But then the pandemic hit, and an eviction moratorium settled in. Archie is not a wealthy landlord. He's not a representative of some posh out-of-state corporation or a multi-site property holder. He describes himself as a simple working man who wants to help his tenants when he can, but also has to pay his mortgage. His story is detailed in the Washington Post, titled "No Safety Net and Little Sympathy: Some Small Landlords Struggle Under Eviction Moratoriums." The Post notes that an estimated 40 million Americans could face eviction this winter. It's a huge problem. And most of the conversation about these renters centers on the landlords as kind of villains. The Post writes, quote, "Typically defined as owners with less than 20 units, small landlords are an important source of affordable housing in the city, but typically don't have the political clout of large developers nor the public sympathy of struggling tenants. There's been no safety net for them. The rental housing providers in various cities are regulated like they are all multinational corporations," end quote. Landlords get pegged as slumlords often when they're not, one housing advocate told the Post, and she continued, quote, "People assume they are in much more advantageous positions than they are in, that they don't have their own bills to pay," end quote. So this hour, we welcome the voice of landlords, three in our community, who want to talk about the challenges they're facing. Again, we've had a lot of conversations about what renters are going through, and we will continue to do that. In fact, I'm sure that will be part of this conversation. But you don't often get the perspective directly from landlords. Let's do that now. Pastor Fritz Longabaugh is the one who reached out to me originally. And Fritz, I'm glad you did that. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Pat Gallagher is with us as well. Pat, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Carl Weeks is also with us. Hi, Carl. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Evan.
Tell us a little bit about your properties and how long you've been doing this. And I'll start with Fritz.
Well, I'm pretty new at this. I've been doing it probably 4 years, and I absolutely agree. Thanks for that introduction, because the stereotype is definitely there. I myself was someone who carried it out. I was preaching at a suburban church one Sunday, and I made reference to a house in my neighborhood that was derelict, and I used the word slumlord, and I didn't even know the man, and I didn't know the situation, and I just judged the whole thing. And I regret that now. I've become a housing provider myself, and I can see that there's a very different side to that story.
What is your housing portfolio? What do you have, I mean, in terms of just how many units, Fritz?
So I would be considered a small housing provider, 9 units.
Okay. Pat Gallagher, same question for you. How long have you been doing it, and how many units?
I've been a housing provider for approximately 20 years, and right now currently I have about 13 units. And that's a mixture of single-family home and two-family homes. And I own Gallagher Property Management, and we manage properties throughout the city of Rochester and Monroe County. And we have approximately 520 units under management, again, from single families all the way up to, like, 10-family homes.
Okay. Carl Weeks, same question for you.
Thanks, Evan. I've been doing this for 38 years full-time, primarily in the city of Rochester. I'm a small property specialist. I have about 160 units that I manage. And to give you a little perspective or reference point, I began doing this before there were cell phones and computers.
You've got some experience under your belt, I take it then, Carl. So you said 38 years. Is that right, Carl?
Not only right, full time, no other distractions, right?
Okay. How common are evictions over your 38 years?
Well, you're talking about court evictions, right? Or actual people getting thrown out. Those are two different.
Well, why don't you start with that distinction then?
Right. So an eviction is when a tenant is actually physically put out via a warrant. And people confuse that with the eviction process. The eviction process starts with a petition to get to the warrant. So, and quite often, There's never an eviction. Quite often there's a workout plan, there's an agreement, there's a solution, there's a win-win outcome. So there's never an eviction, but the process of getting there has been started.
Okay. And how common is that over 38 years?
Extremely. So it grew over time, 80s, 90s, it keeps growing. So to give you some stats here, the Rochester City Court, before the pandemic, they had 40 cases a day for 5 days, right? 200. Now, currently, well, we're on a moratorium right now, but when it did open back up a few weeks ago, they were down to 20 cases a day for 4 days a week. But the numbers needing to get there, I believe, has increased. So you see, we're going to run into a little problem here down the road.
Okay. And so let me kind of just ask all three of you to characterize some of the public discourse that the Washington Post was writing about and that Pastor Longabaugh mentioned, some of those stereotypes. So, Fritz, can you elaborate on that? What is your sense of how the community sort of views evictions, renters? Because, I mean, we have to acknowledge 40 million Americans could face eviction this winter. That is a horrible situation for everybody. We should not want communities that have this much struggle and pain and economic hardship. But what is your sense for what that conversation, that sort of discourse, looks like, and how it sounds from your perspective?
Well, I think it's very natural to have sympathy for people who are being evicted. Nobody wants to be homeless and put out of their home, so that makes a lot of sense. And I think that tenants need a lot of protection for that reason. But I think it's a concern to me when you paint the whole situation with a broad brush and say that all situations of eviction are the landlord's fault or the housing provider's fault, or that they're not justified. Just as there are ethical and unethical landlords, there's also really hardworking ethical tenants, and there's also some unethical tenants. And I think that that is a little bit harder to portray, perhaps, in the media.
Yeah, my sense, Fritz, and I've said this on the program, this is one of those times where I think it's probably important for listeners to understand, my personal bias here, because we have a lot of conversations about what we do about this pandemic. I have said for a long time that I understand the desire to, number one, stop the spread during a pandemic of a deadly disease. And so I understand why bars or restaurants would be closed. I don't understand doing that and not backstopping them with federal support. I think that that has been sort of an injustice that is going to result in, number one, a lot of people not wanting to follow guidelines, and number two, economic hardship that we are currently seeing that's only going to get worse. And then similarly, I think that, what you don't want to do is have people who have lost their jobs, millions of people lost their jobs, can't pay rent, evicted. So I understand the desire to help them, but I also think you've got to backstop or make whole landlords and property owners who have their own mortgages to pay. I mean, I don't understand how you do one without the other. I don't understand how you close bars, but you don't help them economically. You close restaurants, you don't help them economically. You help renters, but you don't help landlords who also have bills to pay. So I think that there are chain effects here, and I've been struggling to understand why they haven't been just addressed in a straightforward manner, simplified way. Is it straightforward to you, or is it more complex than that, Fritz?
Well, I'm going to let others speak about that, but situations are complex. Again, there's a situation where it would be so lovely if courts could step in quickly and provide a remedy in a situation where either a tenant or a housing provider is really being done an injustice. But the speed of action in the courts is just non-existent right now, and I think that's a major problem.
The speed of action is non-existent? I mean, so these cases are not being addressed, or what's – elaborate a little.
Due to the moratorium. Under the best of circumstances before the pandemic, if you had a tenant that was destroying your property or was not paying, it really takes 3 full months for an eviction when you finally get to that point. Most housing providers really do try to negotiate before that happens. But it takes 3 full months for that remedy to take place at the earliest. Now that there's a pandemic and a moratorium, there's a situation in which I personally am going month after month after month with someone whose income has increased, but they've decided not to pay. So there's no end in sight for that. That kind of situation could easily be addressed and should be addressed swiftly in the courts.
Okay. Pat Gallagher, how do you see the public conversation? Do you agree with the Washington Post analysis that there's been a stereotyping of all landlords as the same?
I do. I think so. Anytime I turn on a news anyways, it seems like we're portrayed in a negative light. And, you know, of course, I don't think that's fair. You know, I also do this full time. I'm working this 6 to 7 days a week with my tenants, and weekends I'm still working. So, you know, we're trying to keep people happy, healthy in their homes. And, of course, you know, if people are in a jam, if they can't pay their rent, you know, we have a lot of resources here for them to help them get the aid that's available. So we're always constantly trying because we're in the business for move-ins. We're not in the business for move-outs. So I just don't think that it's portrayed correctly in the news and the media. I think there's a lot more good providers and bad providers. And plus, we actually have building codes that have increased over the years between the Rochester Housing Authority, which is Section 8, and the City of Rochester, which has their code enforcement officers. So you really, there's really no room for landlords that don't address their properties and the issues at their properties. Again, I don't think we see enough of the good guys out there doing the right thing.
Okay, Carl, do you think there's been stereotyping?
Oh, absolutely. From the beginning of time, Evan. And for that reason, we've been on a mission, by the way, not in a good way. We've been on a mission to rebrand our role and what we do. You know, we house people in our community. We try very hard to provide affordable and safe housing. We're housing providers. That's our new term. We're housing providers. That's what we do. It's a business, and we work hard at it. So we're trying to redirect that stereotype in a positive way. Most owners are in that category of trying to do the right thing. I say most because there are a few bad apples out there that gives us a bad name. We should not be all thrown into the same basket. So there are bad ones out there, but there's plenty of laws in the books to take care of them. But, you know, welcome to the world of housing providers.
Well, and listeners, I see the phone ringing. We'll get to your calls and your emails, of which I've got several already, later in the program. And if you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. What I want to do is I just want to get through one other line of line of inquiry with our guests, and then I want to turn it over to some of the comments from listeners. But Fritz, let me start with you on this. So let's talk policy. Let's talk about what is actually being done versus what could be done realistically here. And I take your point that these situations can be complex. I think the Post detailing the story of Archie Jabadi's story is complex because there was one where, you know, unfortunately he was working on an eviction case for more than a year, and then the pandemic hits, and then he can't do it in a case where there has been a failure to pay, drugs, potential violence, middle of the night complaints from neighbors, and now he sort of feels like he can't do anything about that. The neighbors are upset that he can't do anything about that. So I take the point that there is complexity here anytime there is a moratorium. But when you look at state and federal, if you were writing up the pandemic rules, Fritz, what would you do?
First of all, there are forms of aid that are there for tenants. Now, the tenants have to apply for them. I have one that did that successfully and two that didn't even try. So I think that there needs to be more input from the housing provider in the application process. That's one thing I would say. Also, I don't see the need for a moratorium on every single case. I would change that to make it only hardship cases. And I do have tenants that have legitimate hardships, and I don't mind those. They're struggling, and they need some help, and they need some patience. I'm happy to provide that. But I think a blanket moratorium is a bad idea.
Okay. Is there a different set of policies? So you're talking about what you think is maybe not a good idea. Mm-hmm. Are there other things that should happen, whether it's federal or state level, that would be good ideas?
Okay. So I think that you need to have a system whereby someone can prove hardship and have that verified. I think that's very important. If you can't do that, then you've got to allow the case to go through court. So that's one nuance that I would add.
Okay. Pat Gallagher, same question. How would you draw, you know, sort of the emergency or pandemic or crisis situation in terms of state or federal law?
I'm on the same sort of path as Fritz is. I think it's, I mean, it's a great task, you know, for the federal state to come out with these rules and laws. So, but I would get the housing providers more involved. And if they're going to offer assistance and aid and so forth, make it easier for the tenants to apply. And again, get us more involved so we can have some good solid numbers and come together with a solution and get it handled. And I just feel right now it's more on the tenant. And some of these programs are confusing. They're difficult. And people are getting denied. So I would make the process more simple. I would have the housing providers more involved. And with the courts, right now we can only potentially evict if there's a lease violation. And it has to be a pretty serious lease violation, and we have to prove it. So, and Fritz is right. I mean, we do get calls from here and there from time to time where neighbors are calling about the tenant. Why don't you do anything about your tenant? I really can't do anything about my tenant. So we try to address it the best we can. But those are the only cases going through court now are serious lease violations.
Okay. Carl, what do you think?
I concur with Fritz and Pat pretty much. I think one thing that can happen, and it doesn't require a state or federal law, but simply an administrative order from the chief justice of the state. And what that is, when it's the moratorium on evictions, the new one that just came into effect, literally gives a pass to tenants to May 1. There's a May 1 moratorium. They have to provide a hardship declaration. Again, there's no way to confirm that or dispute that. And that's it. All you have to do is sign it, and boom, there's May 1. That's a problem. So what that's saying is we can't do anything to May 1. So what should happen, because the 3 to 4 months it takes to get to the through the process, they should still allow that process to move forward and keep it going down the timeline. So what the judge can do can actually stay a warrant based upon the moratorium timeline or thereafter or at the judge's discretion. So that can happen. So not to have this real pile up come May 1. They should still have the courts open in the meantime.
Carl, I mean, with 160 units, how many more people than is typical are unable to pay rent during this pandemic?
All right, so there's different categories. We have tenants that are paying rent with what they can during this time. My mantra, do what you can, how much you can, just do the right thing. We have about 8-10 cases where we're into 10, 11, 12 months of no rent. So it's across the board. So I have about 50% of 160, or close to 50%, are in a non-payment, partial payment situation.
Okay, 50%. And again, what would typically be, if we were talking a year ago today, what would that number have been? What would that percentage have been, Carl?
Oh, we'd be down to 10-15%.
Okay. 10-15%, and now it's 50%. Let me read an email from a listener who's got some criticism for me and some criticism for our guests. So we'll answer both those. This is from Ray Ray, who I actually know. I mean, he's been on this program. He's a really loving person who cares deeply about this community. Ray Ray says, it would be lovely if small landlords like your guests had the will to organize each other and demand government stop banks from collecting mortgages and get relief for themselves. Instead, you are just simply asking to be able to evict tenants who can't pay. It should be on the, it should not be on the tenants to get this relief. You are not acknowledging the power imbalance here. The commodification of housing is inequitable, period. Your business model may be suffering. Your basic human rights of a roof over your head are not. You will lose money. People should not be losing their homes. Evan, these both sides conversations are killing us, literally. These are not restorative conversations with equitable facilitation. The platform you are providing for these people who make a living off an extractive, predatory, exclusivity, incentivizing market is dangerous. Small landlords aren't going to conscious capitalists our way out of people's housing needs not being met. That's from Ray Ray. And so let me address the criticism of me, because I always welcome it. And, you know, Ray Ray has sent some really good and helpful criticism in the past. So I take the point that you're making, that you see a system, Ray Ray, that is inequitable from the outset, and that tinkering within the system is not the way to do this. You want a whole other system, and I hear that. But I think hearing the voices of people's human experiences is always valuable. I think you should not be afraid to let landlords, small landlords, voice what their lives have been like, and then you could decide what you think is fair as an outcome. What they've been saying, what the Washington Post said recently, is that they're often left out of these conversations or sort of caricaturized. And it wasn't just Fritz Longobaugh's email that sparked this conversation. I had a conversation with someone who works in the social justice movement, who is very well known, who works very hard, who is, you know, who has been there and probably marched with you, Ray Ray, who told me that this person has family who own property, and this person is tired of the stereotyping that the social justice movement, this person feels, does regarding property owners, and just feels like there is a disconnect there, and. Yeah, urged me to think about it. So it wasn't just these landlords said, hey, give us a chance to talk about this. I mean, there are people who are really hurting. And even people in social justice reaching out saying, I think we need to think about this more deeply. I'm not taking sides here, and I'm with you, but I am not going to shy away from just at least hearing about the experiences of people like Fritz, Pat, Carl. Listeners can decide, boy, they seem like decent people who are doing their best. Or listeners can decide, no, you're part of the problem. But that's going to be up to listeners. And I'm not afraid of providing that platform for them. I also understand why they've been frustrated by, you know, what they perceive as some of the broad brushing, let's just say. That doesn't mean they're right about everything. That doesn't mean, but I think we should understand a wide range of experiences. And I know that's going to disappoint some people, and I am sorry that it does disappoint some people, but...
Can I jump in?
On the subject of the commodification of housing as being inequitable and what the landlords, what the property owners ought to be doing, Fritz, Pat, Carl, you want to go ahead? Is that Carl or Pat? Is that Pat?
I think it was Fritz.
Oh, Fritz. Go ahead, Fritz.
Well, Ray Ray, in many ways, I agree with what he's saying. However, what I think we're hurt by is people who can pay but won't. And believe it or not, there's a pretty sizable group of folks like that. So the people that can't pay, they need help. They need compassion. And I know the three of us providers, we give that. We offer that. But it's really the folks that won't pay. Well, part of my business is devoted to helping people get into home ownership. And I think that's really exciting. So if he, by commodification, means, you know, extracting all the wealth just by keeping people in rental housing, that's really not the goal here. The goal here is to provide good housing and good neighborhoods for people. And that's what gets us excited about the job that we do.
But Fritz, to Ray Ray's point, and Ritty also writes us an email saying that small landlords should be putting pressure above, not below. So their point is, if you're hurting, you ought to organize and aim your sights above your heads, not below, and get relief that way. What do you say to that, Fritz?
There is an advocacy group called Under One Roof that does exactly that. And again, that's a good point that the caller makes.
Okay. Pat, what do you think?
Well, you know, we provide a service, and, you know, applicants and tenants come to us, and to me it's a relationship. It's a fair exchange. We don't own government housing. It's a private housing that we do run, and, again, people come with us, and the fair exchange is based on the product that we present. We come to agreement. There's a lease involved. Rent has to be paid, and in return, we have to be very responsive to keep the unit in good condition, take care of the repairs and so forth. So a lot of times people want to rent. They don't want to own a home because when there's a sewer backup, when there's a furnace issue, they get on the phone, make a phone call. And that has a lot of advantages. Plus, you're free to move. With 30-day notice, you can move. And a lot of people like that. They don't want to be stuck with a home. So that's it. To me, it's all about the relationship. So we're very careful when we screen, and we want the person to be 100% comfortable before they come over. And it's all spelled out in the contract through the lease. And we sign, and we go from there. So I don't like when people say sides and there's these issues and problems. It shouldn't be that way. You know, if there's a problem and if you don't like something that we do and if we can't resolve it, then you're free to go somewhere else. That's a freedom of choice that you have. But, you know, in this pandemic, unfortunately, like Chris is saying, you're just having more and more people taking advantage of this. And to me, they should be called out. You know, there should be some more checks and balances. Okay. Again, we want to keep people in their homes. We don't want them out.
Carl, what do you think?
Yeah, it sounds like Ray Ray has this pool all into one body of ownership. But the fact is the majority of housing providers, owners, investors are the small guy, mom-and-pop shops. And again, we're in the business of housing people trying to do a good job. Right now, we are not making a profit, just like the restaurants. Right? They're just trying to keep the doors open. Right now, we're trying to keep the tenants in. Right, if they're making a good faith efforts to pay. So there is a distinction. I hear what he's saying, but we're not in this other group that has the ability to do bigger and better things than what we can do. Again, to reiterate, there is a very strong advocacy group under one roof doing just that, and we do a lot with Albany down there trying to make change.
Well, I think it will be helpful to at least find out if you agree with people like Ray Ray who say, you know, the housing should be a human right. Carl, do you think housing is a human right?
That's a tough one. You know, for an independent private property owner, no, it's a business. And until it becomes a non-business, that might change. But the federally backed mortgages or properties backed by the federal government, maybe those complexes should be the right to have a property. I don't know. I don't know, really.
Pat, what do you think?
Well, I mean, right now, the way the system's set up is we provide a service. There's an exchange that takes place. Other services you pay for. You take your car to the shop, you pay for that service. You go to the grocery store, you pay for your food. And it seems like we're treated differently. So, I mean, we have to pay for these properties, whether you have a mortgage or not. You still have your taxes and insurance and other expenses. And like Carl says, nobody's getting rich with this. It is the mom and pop. We're trying to keep our properties up. Plus, we want to be in compliance with Section 8 in the city. So that's what we're doing, and we're working hard at that.
Fritz, what do you think? Is housing a human right?
I think it's too vague of a statement to be helpful. I mean, if it is a right, someone's still got to unplug the toilets, and someone's got to do the repairs, and someone's got to take care of the house. And who is that going to be? And usually it becomes the most responsible people involved who run the most houses. And so is it a right? I don't know. It comes down to who's going to be responsible for maintaining good housing. That's, I think, a more helpful question.
All right, let's get to your phone calls after our only break. And I see the phone continuing to ring. So we got plenty to get through on the other side of this break as we talk to Fritz Longabaugh, Pat Gallagher, Carl Weeks. They are all they would like you to use the phrase housing providers. You may think of them as landlords. And we're talking about the plight of renters, but also the plight of landlords during this pandemic and what happens next year. And your phone calls are next after this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, Governor Andrew Cuomo wants to see marijuana legalized recreationally in this state, as a number of other states have done. So what should it look like? If it now seems to be inevitable that New York State will see a legalization of recreational marijuana, how should the state tax it? Where should it be sold? What limits should be in place? Who should benefit? We'll discuss all of that on Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Robert in Fairport first. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I think that there's a lot of unintended consequences in having people not pay rent for, it's going to be over a year, I think, by the time this thing gets ironed out. I mean, houses, I mean, if you own a house, you're very familiar with this. You got water heaters, you got roofs, you got furnaces, you got bathrooms, all this kind of stuff that needs replacement and fixing and all that kind of stuff. And if you're not making enough money to replace these things, you know, you have a problem. And I think the problem here is that you're teaching landlords a lesson to get out of the business. And I think that I know a fair amount of people that do rent houses, and they're smaller landlords, and they have seen this as an effective way to make money. And I think that they really have learned a valuable lesson here to get out of it. It's too risky. And the state can take away their livelihood at any time. There's a real kind of a reverse moral hazard here, that you're putting your own money up, but the state can dictate that you don't have to be paid for providing a legitimate service.
Fritz, you want to start? What do you think?
Well, I have to say, Robert, I think that's a really good thought, and I agree with it.
Anything you want to add, Pat?
No.
Okay.
Getting back to if it's a human right, I just don't want the government to dictate everything and have more control. I want to be able to choose what I want, spend what I want. I agree with what the caller said.
Okay, Carl.
Same thing, Evan. I agree 100%. Nice call.
Actually, I have a thought that I'd like to add, and
sure.
It's taking the long-term view about Robert's point of view. I think providers are being taught that this is a bad investment right now. It's a horrible investment right now. And there are already, at least in the neighborhood I serve, there's tons of abandoned houses. There's going to be a lot more. And the houses that are in good repair now are probably going to get worse because there is this massive disincentive for people to be good landlords.
Michael in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think my situation is probably like a lot of other small landlords. So I have a tenant who's in one of my properties. He has been there for 2.5 years. Last January is the last time he paid rent. So that was pre-pandemic. He has, in the meantime, flooded an office below him like 4 times, where I've had to replace light fixtures and ceiling tiles. That's a professional office that's happened to. And then he's pulled an expensive smoke alarm off the hallway wall twice, where I spent over $500 in one case just getting someone back there to rewire and install the detector. So the way the system's set up right now, as Carl mentioned, the system is so unfair. It's so one-sided. There's no recourse to help people like us in a situation where the person hasn't paid and has no interest in paying. I was due in court 2 weeks ago tomorrow, and then the moratorium hit again, and now it's May 1st. So I don't know what else to do. I have no idea what recourse I have. I've spoken to an attorney, and I'm just in a waiting game now.
Okay, Michael. I mean, Fritz, is there anything you want to add about what you think he ought to be doing?
There's a landlord support group, and when I first heard that term, I laughed out loud because it doesn't sound like a very likely term. But Pat actually and Carl both run landlord support groups, and they are excellent. That's the good news. However, I would say the bad news is you're right. There really isn't a recourse right now, and we just kind of have to take it. Some people try to buy their tenants out and say, look, I'll give you $1,000, and you may owe me $6,000, but I'll let go of that, and I'll pay you $1,000 or $2,000 just to leave. And there are providers who are taking that option, and it breaks my heart.
Pat or Carl, anything you want to add there?
Yeah. So the caller, the problem with all these different orders and a lot of the attorneys are not even caught up to speed. They're fumbling like we are too. Even the folks in the judicial system trying to maneuver through all this stuff. But my suggestion is the latest moratorium does allow for filing of an eviction for egregious cases of lease violations. Sounds like he might be in that category. So see an attorney that's up to speed with the current order that's listed there.
Is there let me just ask, and I'll ask Fritz here. I think what we have this hour is a conversation about some of the challenges that landlords are facing. I want to emphasize the point that you've tried to emphasize, which is the concern is the people, as you say, who can afford to pay, who just aren't. It is not a bashing of people who are in hard times and can't pay their rent.
I
think those who advocate for housing rights and for renters are arguing that landlords are often claiming, well, you're not paying, but you could. You're just choosing to game the system when a lot more people are hurting than you realize. Is it possible, Fritz, that that's true?
Yeah, of course it is. One of the advantages of being a small provider is that I know and relate with my tenants frequently. And we have a kind of – and actually, you know what? For Carl and Pat, too, they are relators. They know their people. And you know people's situations, and you start caring about them, and you're willing to negotiate at times. But you also know when someone is doing wrong. I just got to be blunt about that. And there is a real difference. It is possible that a provider could come down too hard on somebody. It is sometimes hard to know. And so one of the thoughts I've had is it would be great if someone like the Housing Council had some kind of like triage system where you could do a quick Zoom call where you have a mediator between the tenant and the provider. And then before going to court, that happens. But then there's some action early on that could help at least begin addressing the problem. And, of course, you got to provide documentation. If you say you've lost your job, you got to provide documentation for that. If there's been a pay cut, those things can be documented, and that makes things pretty clear.
Okay, let me get back to some comments from listeners, and I guess we're going to go to – let's see here. This is Keith next. Go ahead, Keith.
I have an interesting show. The question was asked, is housing a right? And I believe it is, but that doesn't mean it should be provided by businesses. If the government should supply subsidized housing or affordable housing if they can't afford the market rate. I know in Europe, a lot of middle class live because the cities are older and bigger, and the cost of living is higher. There is a lot of public housing in Europe that basically middle class people live in. I mean, you hear the phrase public housing, and most people think poor people and cringe. But what I wanted to ask your landlords, what's happening with people who have been living, you know, going on a year rent free? About their utilities, are they paying RG&E, and is there a moratorium on shutoff if they can't pay the rent?
Yeah, it is interesting that when you don't pay your RG&E bill, it gets shut off. When you don't pay your phone bill, it gets shut off. That's not the case with us.
Right.
Wow. Pat, Carl, you want to jump on that?
Inherently
too?
Wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, apparently, okay, yeah, RG&E cannot be turned off either right now. And apparently they can't be turned off, I think it's 3 to 6 months after moratorium expires. All right, so, and some tenants know this. And, again, only the small minority group of tenants, the small percentage that we have that are doing this, that their RG&E is not getting turned off, they're not paying rent, and then the water is not going to get turned off as well. Because that's if it's not paid by the tenant, if it's in their lease that they have to pay and they don't pay, ultimately the landlord is stuck with the water bill or will go on the tax bill. So, again, most people are paying. Most people are up front. Most people are doing what they can, and it's great. It just seems like the numbers, the small group that's not starting to increase, and, again, that's what's making our day more difficult to handle.
Let me add that, Pat, that there's the HEAP program is a very active program for paying back RG&E bills. So many of the tenants utilize the HEAP program, and there's other agencies, many other agencies out there that also pays back RG&E bills. So they have that resource to keep the utilities on.
Let me read some more feedback before I get back to your phone calls. Listener who asked that I not use their name says this. I care deeply about social justice and meeting the housing needs of all. I am now struggling with being on the other side of the conversation. Last fall, my mother and I used most of our savings to purchase a condominium to give my parents housing security when they can no longer work. It is the first property that I've ever owned and that they have ever owned in their lives. It was a major stretch for both of us. We have never been landlords before. We now have a tenant that owes over $10,000. We've had to pay out more than that to maintain the property. This has put us in financial distress to the point where I could lose my own home. The tenant has been denied for all programs. So that is a listener who just wanted to share some of what they are facing and going through. But on the other side of that, Amanda says, Evan, I'm a small landlord, and frankly, I'm really tired of being used to distract from the issues that tenants are facing in our community. First, we need to acknowledge that even small landlords have more power and responsibility. We literally call them investment properties, and not all investments are guaranteed to profit. That said, small landlords are only ever brought up to defend the big corporate landlords, the same way small businesses are used to shield big corporations. Small landlords and tenants, while there's certainly an inequity there, are more alike than we are different. It's up to small landlords to fight alongside tenants, not fight against them. And why doesn't this conversation have anyone from the tenants' union or from a balanced perspective? That's from Amanda. So, Amanda, we have had programs in the past where we've had landlords and tenants' union on together. Recently, especially during this pandemic, we just haven't had the voices of landlords. We've had mostly renters, renters' rights, tenants' union, and you know, we just started to hear from landlords saying, you know, you've been missing us from this and that we're hurting too. The goal is not to leave anybody out. That's why we open phone lines and open emails. And I can just about guarantee you we'll have a follow-up conversation with folks in tenants' union and renters' rights to respond to some of what they're hearing today. But I appreciate that, Amanda. I do. And Fritz, you're the one who's got the smallest number of properties. She says you ought to be fighting alongside your tenants, that you and your tenants are more alike than different. What do you think?
I absolutely agree with that. Because I mean, that's why I became a provider, because I care about the neighborhood where I'm a minister. And it's my paycheck. But I do fight for those folks, and it's really important to me. These are people I care about and in some cases love. And we're on the same side. Eviction is bad for everybody. Everybody is when there's an eviction. And if there could be a quick system for mediating that or getting right to the issues much sooner than is currently going on, then I think that we'd see a lot of success, and because we really are on the same side. They want a nice home. We want to maintain a nice home. We want to be paid. They want to pay a reasonable rate. And there's every reason why we can work this out, but there is an adversarial feeling so often. And when I first get to know a tenant, one that I've inherited from a previous provider, it takes generally about 3 months to win their trust and say, look, I'm on your side. You can talk frankly with me. I'm going to talk frankly with you. It takes time to develop that trust, but Amanda is correct. We can be on the same side.
Jonathan writes to say, Evan, it's upsetting that your guests are unable to say the seven words, yes, housing is a basic human right. Nobody blames anyone who is struggling right now, but come on, the blame doesn't fall solely on them. But not acknowledging that we all deserve shelter is a big part of the problem. And Jack in Pittsford on the phone wants to weigh in on that point too. Go ahead, Jack.
And then that's exactly what I thought of. The fact that your guest here, all of them, hesitated, could not just flat out state housing is a human right, is a non-starter. And they want sympathy. As Amanda stated, it's an investment. It's an investment. And I'm sure these are the first type of guys that would say, we don't need government handouts, I'll buy our bootstraps, and all of this. I'm sure they voted for Trump, too. No sympathy here. None. None.
Thank you for the phone call. Well, let's ask our guest to respond to the points on housing as a human right. I'll start with Carl. Go ahead, Carl.
It could be a human right, right? But it needs to be paid for somehow. There are expenses. Again, I'm on the fence with this human right thing. I think going back to working with the tenants, you know, my approach, and I think most small housing providers' approach, is to develop a win-win outcome. That's what we're aiming for. And I think a lot of people that are not in this business don't realize that. Right now, fortunately, and I think they'll be glad to know, that right now, the way the courts are structured is it's mandated now. It's mandatory for you to go out into the hallway and develop a win-win situation for your case to move forward. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. It's kind of new. So alongside of it being a right, I think I don't know.
Well, Carl, it's not the business that we're in, right? I mean, if there is such a program for free housing and a right, then go pursue it. You know, go do it. And that's your choice. That's your freedom. That's what you can do. The businesses that we're in, as housing providers, there's an exchange, a fair exchange. Someone is income qualified to meet our qualifications. We accept them in. And it's a partnership. It's a relationship. I want it to win. I want my tenant to perform, do well, be responsible, and it's a win-win. That's what we want, and everybody's happy. Whether that lasts a year or 5 or 10 years, that's what it's about. But what we offer is not that. You know, that the free, we just don't offer that. So, and again, a person has a right to say, I don't want to rent from you. Not a problem. Then you can go somewhere else.
Okay, Fritz.
Well said.
Yeah, the challenging question, as Carl indicated also, is that who pays for it? Who pays for that right? In the scenario right now, it's we, the housing providers, that pay for it. Is New York State going to pay for it? Okay, that's one set of circumstances. But New York State is probably going to say to the tenant, well, we want you to pay 30% or 60%. And that's basically what a Section 8 situation is. But someone's got to pay for that human right. And I think that, for me, the language of justice is much more helpful, because tenants need and deserve justice. And I think that housing providers also need and deserve justice.
Well, on that subject, Ken writes to say, any government-imposed eviction moratorium must include a second step, namely, banks cannot demand payment of that portion of a mortgage derived from tenants under moratorium. The problem is that banks still demand payment in full of their mortgages. Landlords are being squeezed between the demand for payment by banks and the failure or inability of tenants to pay rent. And a moratorium on tenant eviction tightens the squeeze on landlords. Thus, when government issues a moratorium on tenant evictions, the banks must also be told by government that they must forego payment of that portion of the affected mortgage. Again, Fritz, I know you've said it's more complicated than that, but that's from Ken. What would you say to Ken?
I agree it's true. I tried to stop the mortgage on one of my properties, and you can delay it, but you've got to still, the interest keeps accruing. And so that's also true. But I would again say that I think a lot of those kinds of situations, if the tenant is able to pay but not paying, you don't need to ask the banks to swallow that. You just need access to a justice system. In a situation where the tenant cannot pay, then again, they need compassion and they need negotiation. And that would be a scenario to approach a bank for the caller's ID.
Pat, anything you want to add on that?
Yeah, it definitely in these times, if a landlord has a mortgage, and plus the taxes are still due, we still have to pay them. If you don't pay on time, there's a penalty. So it's really tough for a lot of landlords that do have those mortgages, because like Fritz said, eventually it has to be paid, and the interest is accruing. So I agree.
All right, I'm going to squeeze in one more phone call, and it is Michael. This is Eric in it's David in Rochester. Hi, David, go ahead.
Hello, Evan. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I am a local homeowner, and I have a tenant who has a month-to-month lease, and they're behind rent for the past 7 months, about $4,200. And it's been quite a struggle because I'm unemployed. And I was, I'm on Social Security, and I was, looking for this money to help pay the mortgage. And I just feel like this person is a, quote, professional squatter. They know how to play the rules, and I'm, I have to pay the mortgage. I live in Irondequoit, so I pay the mortgage. Taxes, water bill, garbage, internet, and phone.
Okay. Anything you want to add to, Carl, what would you say about his experience there?
Well, he just explained a very, very common scenario. So this is his situation is in high numbers out there. And like Fritz is saying, we need to get into a mediation type environment. the judicial system somewhere to get this resolved.
All right. Well, Fritz, you're the one who reached out originally here in our last 40 seconds. What do you want to leave with listeners who are really split, you know, reading the email, really sort of a heavy split here about how people feel about some of these themes raised today here? What do you want to leave with listeners?
Well, if we don't figure this out, we are all in trouble. Not only the housing providers, but also tenants, because the housing stock is going to plummet, and housing providers who are being punished now are just going to vanish. And City of Rochester, I'm just worried about what that will be. Again, I would focus on justice for the tenant and for the landlord, and it is possible.
All right, listeners, we will certainly have more to say about this. I know you will have more to say about this, and others in our community will. And I'm grateful for the time of our guests, three property owners in Rochester. Pastor Fritz Longabaugh, thanks for reaching out. Thanks for being with us.
A pleasure.
Pat Gallagher, thank you. Yeah, thank you for being with us, Pat.
Thank you very much.
Carl Weeks, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for the opportunity, Evan.
You got it. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, the producer. I am Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you Friday on member-supported public radio.